This message is brought to you by Abercrombie & Fitch. I've been ready for summer for a while, and now it's finally time for summer outfits. With a trip coming up, the A&F Vacation Shop has me covered. Abercrombie really knows how to do a lightweight outfit. Their tees, sweater polos, and linen blend shorts never miss. I wear Abercrombie denim year-round. Their shorts are no different and have the comfort I need for summer. Prep for your next trip with the A&F Vacation Shop. Get their newest arrivals in-store, online, and in the app.
With a Venmo debit card, you can Venmo more than just your friends. You can use your balance in so many ways. You can Venmo everything. Need gas? You can Venmo this. How about snacks? You can Venmo that. Your favorite band's merch? You can Venmo this. Or their next show? You can Venmo that. Visit Venmo.me/debit to learn more.
You can Venmo this, or you can Venmo that. You can Venmo this, or you can Venmo that.
The Venmo MasterCard is issued by the Bancorp Bank N.A. pursuant to license by MasterCard International Incorporated. Card may be used everywhere MasterCard is accepted. Venmo purchase restrictions apply.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Tech Entrepreneur on a Mission podcast. My name is Ton Dobbe, and I'm the founder of Value Inspiration and the author of The Remarkable Effect. I envision a world where every B2B SaaS startup succeeds because they're creating software that customers would miss if they were gone. And here's why. Research consistently shows that 90% of all startups fail, and that's bad. What's worse, however, is that 75% of SaaS scale-ups fail, companies that are supposed to have product market fit. Far too few scale-ups create the traction they aspire for and fail for the wrong reasons. And I believe this should stop, and hence I created my business. And the goal that I have with this podcast is twofold. First, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential that we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. Secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what it requires to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. The guest on my podcast today is Melissa Kwan, co-founder and CEO of eWebinar.
But the toughest nut to crack is not getting it launched and adopted with your first even 200 customers. The toughest nut to crack is what happens after that, that you've exhausted your entire network and their friends. And I think that was a huge reality check for me because that didn't happen until about a year after launch, because all I know is sales, that I didn't realize that what I need for this business is marketing.
This is Melissa. She's a third-time bootstrap founder. Her previous company, Spatio, was acquired in 2019, and eWebinar was the product she always dreamt about because she was drowning in sales demos, onboarding, and training webinars every day for 5 years. So in March 2019, she made the jump and founded eWebinar. Their mission? To give people their time back so they can do something else more fun, because that's what life is all about. We don't need to work harder. We need to work more creatively. And this inspired me, and hence I invited Melissa to my podcast. We explore how she built a 1 million ARR business from scratch, deliberately going the bootstrapped way. Melissa elaborates on her experience in building software that helps her customers provide experiences that their customers love to engage with. She talks about how getting her first 200 customers was easy, but how growing beyond that became a big challenge, and how she overcame that. And last but not least, she shares some of her secrets to creating a SaaS business without getting into the vicious cycle of desperately chasing funding. And by listening to this podcast, you will learn 4 things. Firstly, why she is, being an automation passionate, betting on SEO and LinkedIn content creation instead of cold outreach automation. Secondly, what's her secret to creating predictable traction knowing there are no shortcuts? Thirdly, how doubling her prices became a blessing for her business in many different ways. And last but not least, why she would opt for bootstrapping her company again if she would have to make the choice again. Well, hi, Melissa. Thank you for making the time available today and being the guest on my podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, that was kind of an easy choice, but you made it through my gate and you donated on a good cause, like saving the waves. No, but when I saw what you were up to with your company, I mean, I had to invite you for the podcast. First of all, because I've lived your problem as well, the problem that you solve. And yeah, I mean, the way you phrase it just triggered me.
When were you living that problem?
When I was at Unit 4. Well, a couple of times I lived it myself because I was doing webinars at Unit 4 as well. And you just do the same thing again and again and again. But I also saw that, of course, salespeople day after day doing the drill.
Yeah.
And of course, you get good at it. But you also see that sometimes you just lose interest and energy. And that's not good.
Yeah.
And there's better ways to use your time and energy. And that's where automation and technology really can help. So kind of to make the link to the podcast that I'm running, when I started this podcast in 2018, it was about, you know, the value that we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. And I think this is a very good example of that. Mm-hmm. Let's first talk about a little bit about you and then move to the whole purpose of the podcast and talk about your business and reveal a little bit of the secrets that we've just been throwing into the air. So as a person, what drives you? What gives you energy?
Wow. Okay. I don't know if anyone's asked me that in that way. What drives me, I guess, at least gives me energy in a professional sense, is the idea of freedom. Like, why are we doing this? Right? We're not doing this because we can have all the money in the world, right? We're doing this because we can be free. Free to make our own choices, call all of our own shots, do whatever we want, live wherever we want, travel. That's what drives me. Is even though things are hard, and as you know, building a company, every day is a new challenge, especially in a SaaS business and a product-led business where you're not talking to people every day, right? You're just trying to grow this business behind a screen. It can get very mundane and boring, but the idea that, hey, we're working towards something that will ultimately give me the life that I want, that's the thing that gets me going.
Yeah, well, very good thing. And that's the way it should be, you know. At some point, like, enough is enough, and then it should go to start to pay back in freedom, like you say.
Yeah, you would think so. You would hope so, at least.
Yeah, I mean, I'm running my own company as well, and that's what I'm doing it for. So, yeah, talking about on your LinkedIn profile, I saw, and on your website as well, I saw that you were working for a real estate company in SaaS as well a couple of years ago. Got acquired and you were going through some of the motions, but it decided to start this company, eWebinar. What was the big problem that you saw, that you lived, that was screaming for something else?
Yeah. So just giving the audience some context, in my previous company, it was an enterprise SaaS company.
Yeah.
So we only sold to big companies. And what happens when you sell to a big company is you have to train all their employees and all their agents to use your product. If they don't use it, of course, it's your fault. It's not their fault. And then they're not going to continue. So training and onboarding is the lifeblood of our company. But in the past, I mean, right now as well, because we've always been bootstrapped, super, super resource constrained. I was everything except for coding. So as you can imagine, I was sales, marketing, accounting, janitorial services, training, onboarding, customer success, everything. So while it was so exciting to sign a new company because it would take us closer to profitability, it was so exhausting to do the same onboarding, training, demos every day. And even though they were for different companies, the software is the same. And then all these people would sign up, but like maybe 10% of people would show up because we were also selling into real estate. So these are real estate agents with their own schedule. You are at the bottom of their priority list. Right? They're not going to sit there Tuesday at 11 with their coffee watching your webinar. They're going to go and show a client a house. So all these companies, not only did they want me to do their onboarding and training, they wanted me to do them all the time. And so I was looking for software back then to help me do my job because it just felt so repetitive. So I could go and do something else. Some days I would even have eight, like my peak, I think I had eight back-to-back like launches, like onboardings. And then, you know, you start off it with pretty high energy, but at the end of the day, you're kind of just done with it, right?
True.
And so, you know, it just never made sense to me why a video couldn't do what I was doing, but like putting something on a YouTube is not the same as joining a webinar where things are interactive, right? So I always dreamt up this kind of automated webinar software that would deliver a video with the interactivity, with the chat, with the engagement, without losing that personal touch.
Yeah.
Right. So that was like, I just thought about this for so long. Like, what if I had this thing? And so after my previous company was acquired, this was the one idea that kept coming back to me. And I couldn't believe that it hadn't been solved yet, like in the way that I envisioned. There were things out there, but they didn't serve the market that I wanted. They almost felt like kind of scammy marketing products. They weren't like enterprise products that was kind of the Netflix of webinars. And all these companies were dumping money into live broadcasts, like Zoom, Instagram, Facebook, like everybody was dumping money into live broadcasts, but nobody was solving the biggest problem of live broadcasts is how do you scale content that works for you? I don't want to do this once a quarter. I want to do this every single day. So having lived that so painfully for so many years, I started this company 2 months after my previous company was acquired.
Yeah. And here we are on a podcast.
Yeah. And here we are.
Your business is doing well. It was very recognizable when I read what you were up to. And it's so true. You know, the frustration starts with the no-shows.
Yeah.
The people that sign up. I mean, you get all these invitations these days on LinkedIn and to attend this event and that event. And it's at 6 o'clock and it's 6:30 and it's four in the afternoon. And I mean, out of everything that I maybe sign up for in the first place, I mean, maybe 90% I don't show up.
Yeah. I mean, people sign up because they want the replay and then nobody watches the replay. Like how many replays are sitting in our email inbox right now? And, you know, I've done webinars where one person showed up and then 20 minutes in, like you already don't want to do it because one person is there instead of, you know, 20 people, but then you still have to do it because they're live. And 20 minutes in, the person leaves and I still have to continue doing it because I know the replay is going to go out. And, you know, you tell the same jokes and all that stuff, but like that really is where like it's a bit soul crushing, right? That's where the mental exhaustion comes in is you're like, I could just be doing anything else, but I'm doing this right now.
Exactly. Yeah, true. So it's loaded with emotions, loaded with pains. And on your website, the line that triggered me was automated webinars without losing personal touch. And I think that is also like, I've been looking in these for these type of products as well, but I couldn't indeed find them. So why is it so hard to kind of make the automation part maybe is the easy part. Everybody can imagine that you do that, but then the personal touch, how do you solve that part?
Yeah. So I think what we really thought about was what is the video consumption experience we want people to have, right? What makes a webinar different than a video, right? So number one, of course, it's chat, right? The ability to reach out to the host makes me feel closer to you, like as the company or whether you're a company I'm already working with or you're someone I'm trying to decide. Like it makes me feel like I can reach out to you. I think that's number one. It's no different than going to a website and having a little chat bubble and say, hey, can I help you today? That makes me feel like I can reach you. That is the fundamental difference between a webinar event and just a video on YouTube. Or you can say that YouTube has comments, but that's not where people chat, right? People, that's not a chat. That's just a comment box. I think that's number one. Yeah. And number two is the ability to participate. And what do I mean by that? It could be a poll comes up, right? A question comes up, a quiz comes up, right? But because we are only focused on automation, we want to deliver the most engaging experience possible. We actually have developed over 20 what we call interactions. So it could be like little pop-ups that said, oh, Melissa just bought today. It could be a quiz. It could be a contact form. So as you're watching, we want people to not just sit back and play on their phones. We actually want people to focus on the screen and answer things and hit buttons and see like little pop-ups that come up. So it's more of a two-way participatory experience and not just a one-way consumption where you're talking at me for an hour. Because if you're doing that, you're losing me to Instagram. And I think we've all been kind of guilty of that. So we focus on really the ability for people to get in touch anytime they want. So we built in a chat where if you type in a question, if there's someone on the other side, then they can respond in real time. But if not, you'll get a little autoresponder that says, hey, I got your message, but I'll respond to you later. So people know they set the expectation for when they will get a response. And that's a lot of times enough. And we are already used to that kind of asynchronous communication. But number two is we really focus on delivering a beautiful experience that you can interact with. So it's so much more than a video. We layer on interactions on top of the video so people feel like they're having fun while consuming the content. And what ends up happening is people stay till the end and you actually get to deliver your CTA because your webinar is no good if people don't watch till the end, whether it's a marketing webinar or a training one, right? You want them to learn everything to the end or you want them to stay until your offer comes up. So we do all these things to make sure that we keep people on the screen and we want to wow them and make them feel like, hey, this is something I've never seen before.
Let me make a small interruption here. Melissa just made an excellent remark about how she has created defensible differentiation for her solution by focusing on helping her customers give their customers a feeling they've never seen before. She focuses on the outcome that matters, not merely enabling their customers to run a webinar. Everyone can help you run a webinar, but few will help your customers stay until the end. It's a trait remarkable software companies master. They have an insane level of curiosity, focus on the essence, and then create something that's both valuable and desirable. That's what people talk about. And you can master these traits as well. And the first step? Simply read my book. I've made the electronic version available for free. Just visit theremarkableeffect.com to grab your copy, and inspiration will spark within the next 10 minutes. Back to the interview. That's also what I figured out, or what I assumed when I was looking at your website. So, well, thanks for articulating that. And I mean, I wrote the book The Remarkable Effect, so I'm all about that. That's the way it works at the end, you know? It's hard enough for people to sit into a webinar and to get the engagement going. But I also think at the end is because you're doing it in an asynchronous way almost, an on-demand way, you can really play with that so that it's always the right moment to show something where the engagement hits, rather than with a live experience. Yeah, it's just like almost like hit and go.
Yeah, I mean, I think anyone that's run a live webinar that's big, like of any size, even like a medium size webinar before on your own, you know how hard it is to answer every single question. And then you're worried about the connection dropping off. So you're kind of like secretly clicking the chat box to see are people still there.
Yeah.
But when it's automated, your focus 100% of your attention on responding and creating an experience that answers all the questions, all the objections up front. So you can say, hey, like, I'm curious if you like our new offering or like our new feature. And then you can pop up a poll in place. And then the more you run it, here's the magic, right? The more you run it, the more that poll gets answered and the better data you're actually getting, right? Exactly. The first question that I ask in my demo is, how did you hear about us? 56% of people that watch my demo answer that question.
Yeah.
And about 300 people are in my demo every single month. I don't do any demos live. They just go to our website and they join the demo live. That data is so valuable to the activities that we do every single day, of course, especially as a bootstrap company, but anybody that cares about where they should better spend their time, like the more you run it, the better data you're getting. So there's a lot of different benefits, but also, as you mentioned, because it's asynchronous, people are able to actually join at their own time. Like the average attendance rate across all of our customers is 65%. And any marketer will know that is exceptionally high.
Exceptionally, yeah.
And we have companies that only do on-demand. They don't have any scheduled. It's just, you come here, you can watch it right now. Their attendance rate is between 90 to 95%. Because you're actually giving people a choice to join when they're free, not when you're free. Yeah.
True.
So I think it removes that limit of relying on someone else's schedule for your growth, which I think from a business perspective is really important, is giving people content when they want it, when they're ready to consume, not when you're ready to give it to them.
True. Yeah. I think the biggest fear for a lot of companies is, okay, yeah, it's recorded. Is it going to be valuable for people? I mean, why wouldn't they, you know, watch it on YouTube, for example? But I think you can quickly get over that.
I mean, I think they can watch it on YouTube. Like sometimes we upload the video on eWebinar and YouTube. And then in the YouTube comment, we'll say, hey, for the full experience, sign up for this webinar.
Yeah, true.
Right. And I think nowadays, like people are consuming content everywhere. Maybe you like YouTube. Maybe you like webinars. Maybe you like TikTok or, you know, whatever medium that you choose. All we can do as a business is to make sure we're available. Yeah. And then using those channels to drive people to the one that you ultimately want them to end up at. And of course, that's harder to do because it does require a lot of man hours and, you know, to create those. But the beautiful part is you can create one video, upload it in many different places. You can create one video and chop it up. Like there's even now AI like that, like you can just upload a video or a podcast conversation and it spits out 10 to 15 different clips that are 60 seconds, right? It's just becoming easier and easier to repurpose your content. But yeah, I don't think it's like one channel or the other. I think it's as many as you want to appear in and where your audience is.
Completely agree with that. So talking about that journey, you know, you started the business in, let me see, March 2019. What has been a decision that appeared to be critical for where you are right now?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we built the product for about a year and a half before we launched it. So while the company's been incorporated since 2019, the product's been live summer of 2020. I would say the most critical decision that I made was asking my life partner to be my technical co-founder a year into the business. So just a small backstory on that. I had two tech companies before this, both with the same co-founder. I was so sick of managing engineers because I didn't know how. Like I didn't know how to speak their language, that I came into this company thinking I didn't need a technical co-founder. I'm just going to hire a development shop. They're going to do all the coding and I'm going to focus on the business. The biggest problem was the dev shop that we hired, while it was a friend of mine that I trusted, also another mistake, they hugely underestimated the amount of work that it took to build a platform from zero to one. And we were about a year in and nothing was working. Like I couldn't see a launch date on the horizon. And David, who at that point was a fractional CTO for other companies, was like, you know, he was criticizing this and that. And then I was like, you know what? I don't know what they're doing. Why don't you help out and you just see what they're doing and advise? And then he just started kind of coding for free and then things started to work. And I think anyone that's built a tech company before will know the difference between good software and bad software, even if you can't code. Like when things start to work, you're like, okay, now it's, you know, you're a really good coder. So it wasn't about a year in that I was like, why are we paying this development shop that probably can't deliver and is just burning cash every month? Why don't we stop that relationship and you become my co-founder and we can work out an arrangement that's, you know, that works for both of us. So I think that was the critical decision. And I can't tell you how lucky I was because I've been with this guy for years and I didn't know he could code. Like really? I knew he could code, but we never worked together. So I didn't realize he was like the top 1% that you can't actually hire. But it wasn't until then that I was like, okay, I guess this is meant to be. So maybe we can work together. So it's been a journey ever since. And don't forget, like in 2020, nobody could leave their house.
Exactly. Yeah.
So we were doing nothing but working on this business. And I think because of the state of the world we were in, the business probably accelerated 2 times faster than it would have otherwise, because that's all we were doing. Well, we were just working on the business on every waking hour. We were just working on the business. So he was coding for like, I guess, 16 hours a day. And I was trying to prime the business, you know, talking to customers and potential customers, just priming it for a launch. Right. So like we just didn't have a social life. We were also doing that on the weekend. And that was actually when we were stuck in Hawaii for 4 months.
That's another part of course, that's the free part, you know, the kind of the freedom that you're looking for, like being on the road for 9 months a year.
Yeah.
Really good. I mean, I haven't had that one as an example on the podcast so far, and it's been 300 episodes in right now. I mean, I think the next question, maybe I don't even have to ask, the toughest decision you had to make, but let's talk about another one. Maybe the toughest decision was to break up with the development company, but then what was the hardest nut to crack when it comes to launching the product and getting adoption going? Because you talked a couple of times about bootstrapping and that you've been doing that a couple of times right now. I've got some questions for that as well, but particularly with bootstrap mindset and then creating a company that is product-led growth by its origin, how do you start getting the adoption in?
I mean, I think starting was the easiest, right? So I have a background in sales. And I think every company, whether you're a tech company or not, has to start with founder-led sales.
Yeah.
Like you have to be your loudest voice and you have to come up with the sales pitch that works, right? You have to come up with all the value props before someone else can do it. But because I have a background in sales, getting our first 100 customers was the easiest. I did what I do best. I reach out to people. I make a list of people that I know that could potentially use this product. Yeah. I go down the list. I talk to them. I do demos. I mean, ironically, I was doing live demos every day for about 8 weeks before I even automated it. Right? Yeah. Once I got the pitch down, then I was like, okay, I'm ready to automate this. But the toughest nut to crack is not getting it launched and adopted with your first even 200 customers. The toughest nut to crack is what happens after that,
yeah.
that you've exhausted your entire network and their friends, right? Like now what? Everyone that you think will buy from you has already bought, including their friends. Okay, so now I have to go to the third degree and fourth degree and fifth degree. And I think that was a huge reality check for me because that didn't happen until about a year after launch. Because all I know is sales, that I didn't realize that what I need for this business is marketing. I don't know marketing. Like, I don't know SEO and content and hosting on LinkedIn. All that stuff is new, mm-hmm. right? I had to start reading about product-led companies and what do they do and look at other founders and creators and why are they spending so much time posting on LinkedIn? I remember the first time I logged into LinkedIn, probably in 2021, I was like, it's totally a different site. It became a microblogging website. And I'm like, okay, I think there's something about this. So then I took this course by Justin Welsh on how to write on LinkedIn and create content. Crazy. And then I realized there's a whole world of building audiences that I knew nothing about. And I only had to look at that because I exhausted cold calling and cold email, cold outreach. What I learned the hard way is when you're selling a $100 product, people don't pick up the phone, right? They pick up the phone for a $10,000 product because that's what they expect. But you don't see MailChimp having outbound sales team calling you to buy a $49 plan. So I think that really is still the toughest nut to crack is how do you get eyeballs, right? People have to come to your site and, you know, learn about you and click on sign up and give you their credit card. How hard is that? And then they have to keep their credit card in and you have to keep delivering value and letting them know there's value and making sure you stay top of mind. So I think that is truly like the top of funnel lead gen will probably continue to be the toughest nut to crack because it's not an end goal, right? I think we think about like growth and growth hacking and all that stuff as if there's an end goal, right? Hockey stick growth is an end goal, but it's not. It's a continuous process. There's no silver bullet. Everything that you do moves the needle a little bit. I think we're sold this story that, oh, when you do this thing, you'll see this thing called hockey stick growth. It's like, I don't actually know a single company that's experienced that without dumping a bunch of money into it. And all we can do is $0 marketing strategies. We don't have money to dump into this stuff. We only hire people that do things like this. And consumers change, right? How they consume information, where they consume, how long they consume, all of that changes. So that's, I think, a hard reality that I had to come to terms with. And also something that we're continuously trying to experiment and improve every day.
What has been an example that surprised you how well it worked for you?
I can only tell you what surprised me that doesn't work because I actually have never done a thing that I'm like, wow, this works really well. There were so many things that we thought would move the needle that actually didn't. Yeah. For example, getting into a newsletter of 250,000 people, like an integration partner, they've got 250,000 on their list. They're writing a promo or an introduction just for you.
Yeah.
It's just you, right? And these are to their customers. And you must think, hey, we get like 50 signups from that.
Nothing.
I mean, you get like 20 maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I don't think people's attention spans are actually that long, but also they're just more discerning. People are just more picky. And they take a lot more time researching on their own that you can even imagine, right? Like not only are they looking at that newsletter, they're also looking on your social, they're looking on Google to see if you're real. And then they might look on Twitter and Instagram and LinkedIn to see if you've posted recently because that makes you more human.
Exactly.
Right. So there's that. Like another thing could be, you know, making top three on a Tuesday on Product Hunt.
Uh-huh.
Right. That's the busiest day. It's supposedly tech companies, but you've got 500 people writing on your comments and upvoting you. And you think, hey, I get some signups. We got one signup.
My God.
And it's all just a facade. But can I say that doesn't work, or that's not like effort well spent? Because right now we have a page sitting there. Anybody looks us up, we're there, and it makes us look legitimate. True. Right. And maybe that customer was using us and told five other friends.
Yeah.
Right. So this is what I mean by like everything moves the needle a little bit. Like I'm kind of resolved in like 9 out of 10 things we do in like to market ourselves aren't going to work immediately, but I have to have faith that at some point all this comes together, because otherwise, like, why are we here? Right. Why do we work so hard?
Yeah. Well, that's right. Exactly. Well, there are no shortcuts. I mean, when I left Unit 4, a company of about 4,000 people, and then you kind of become a solo entrepreneur, and then you have to do all of those things, of course, that you normally didn't have to do. And you realize it's like there are no shortcuts. You have to just do the hard work. And indeed, it's a compounding effect of a lot of small things.
Yeah. I mean, I think the shortcut is doing small things every day. Yeah. So then you don't have to take, you know, one big leap. Right. And that's more of a strategy. But like, this is what we try to do is like, let's focus on things we can achieve.
Yeah.
Let's not try to map out so many things that we have analysis paralysis and don't do anything. Let's just focus on completing one or two small tasks every day.
Exactly. Yeah. And learn from that and iterate from there. Because sometimes it doesn't work the first time and it doesn't work the second time, but at some point it starts to resonate. Yeah, really important. Has there been any moment where you felt like stuck?
Yeah, all the time. But it's like all the times that I've mentioned, right? Like you feel stuck when you have hope that this thing you do is going to work and then it doesn't, right? And then you're like, well, where's the next level of that, right? If a 250K newsletter is not going to work, then where's the bigger newsletter, right? True. If this podcast that has 1 million downloads a month is not getting me any eyeballs or demos, then where's the next podcast? Like it's scary, right? Because you're like, well, what if I've hit the end of the road? What if I've done everything that I could, right? So I do feel stuck all the time. And I think that's the thing that keeps me up at night is like, okay, well, am I made for this? Am I good enough for this? Am I even the right person to do this? But I don't have enough money to hire someone. And even if I did, who would that person be? Because when you're so early in a startup, like I still feel like we're getting from 0 to 1. So if we can't crack that, then how can we expect someone else to? Like, I think that one of the hard learned lessons that I've had is you can't pay someone to take away your pain, especially as a founder.
Yeah, like, that's true.
And you might be able to, but that person is going to cost, I don't know, 250K, 300, and then it's still going to take time, right? And if I had an extra 250K right now, I'd pay myself.
True.
So, I don't have that right now. But I think that's where I feel stuck is when I feel like something is really good and it doesn't work.
Yeah. How did traction really start? And what have you learned from that? I mean, was that a segmentation thing? Was it a positioning thing? Was it language you used, your value proposition, for example?
I don't know if I can say we've hit real traction. Mm-hmm. Like people aren't like, you know, breaking down the doors and, you know, taking a number to come sign up for us, right? Like I want that day to happen. Yeah. I also don't know if that's like a realistic representation of what traction means. But I will say that things got much easier when we were better at saying no to people.
Very good one.
When we were better at saying, okay, these are not the customers we want to serve. We do not have to impress them. We don't have to service them. We don't have to give discounts. In fact, we should raise our prices to cut the people that we don't want to serve. And actually, that's what we did last year was... because the thing is, when you just launch a product, you can't charge as much as you want. You can only charge as much value as you deliver, comparable to your industry. Yeah. So we had a certain price point. We knew we were going to raise it. We weren't the cheapest, but we weren't the most expensive, but we always focus on the value. And at some point last year, we were hearing more frequently that people were signing up for us because we were the cheapest. Because at that point, our product was already so far beyond, you know, anything out there that they're like, oh yeah, this is really good value. This is cheap. But what happens when your product is perceived to be the cheapest is you are attracting customers that are signing up because it's the cheapest. So they're starting out in their business. They don't have a lot of revenue. They're very cost conscious. They're not tech savvy. So they require so much support and yep. so much help. And then what happens? They don't convert or they churn right away.
Yeah.
So what we did was we just doubled our prices. And, you know, it's not a lot because it's $49 to $99 and at every level we doubled it. Yeah. So for a company that's revenue generating, that's still, you know, pretty cost effective for the hours that we're saving them. And within, I want to say 2 or 3 months, all of that went away.
Very
like all of the, yeah, all of the low tech people, like they just went to cheaper solutions. Right. But we needed to be confident that that change was going to be net positive.
Yeah.
But we were drowning in so much of that, what I call dumb support, yeah. that like it was just like mentally draining, right? Because we were also putting so much love and time into building this thing that we didn't want to serve people that like just wouldn't even put in the time to learn how to use it. So I think that was a pretty good decision. But at that time, it was hard. However, a couple months later, we knew it was the right thing to do.
Well, I mean, at the end, I mean, I wrote about it a lot of times. The moment you do your segmentation wrong, very often the problem starts there. You cannot blame sales for going after leads that have been created by marketing that were off, and especially when you're the same person.
Yeah.
That's even worse then. But yeah, I mean, it becomes like a vicious circle. You attract the wrong type of customer. They buy your solution, not for what it's built for, but for what they think it is. It's cheap. And they have all kinds of questions. And they just keep everybody from their work.
These are people that no matter how much you explain, they just don't get it.
Exactly.
Right? Because some coach told them, oh, you should do this and you should get Zapier. Like if you're not tech savvy, you should not be on Zapier.
No.
And then because those other guys don't respond immediately and we do because we're a small company, now we're supporting them creating their Zaps, which you cannot do that to someone who just doesn't know what they're doing. And then they don't make a sale on their webinar and they're like, oh, this doesn't work for me. I can't afford it. Right. And then it's a bit disheartening. And the thing someone once told me, Melissa, you only don't like supporting them because they're not paying you enough money. Charge them more. Yeah. And then you're going to want to support them. I'm like, yeah, actually, that's a really good point.
Well, it comes down at the end. What is the problem that you're solving and how high is it on their list?
Yeah.
There's a group out there whereby you solve a critical problem. For those people, your solution is not worth $99. It's worth $1,000 a month. Easily. Yeah. You know, they were happy to pay a premium. These are the companies that you want to have. But for the other ones, it's a nice to have. And as a consequence, yeah, $49, it's like, it's still a lot of money, but I give it a try. Totally different mindset out there.
But actually, I'll tell you something that was unexpected. When we did that was we had companies come to us and say, oh, we couldn't sell you internally because you were too cheap. Like their executives were convinced that there was something wrong with us. If we were so good, if we were as good as what they say it is, why is it so cheap? Find out what's wrong with it.
Yeah.
And it was after we raised it that we became more in line with the other things that they had in their company. And then we became legitimate. So there's also that part where you actually self-select into a different category when you price yourself that way. But of course, your product has to catch up, right, to delivering that value. But like, there's definitely a price perception to quality
that is
attached.
Oh, yeah. At the end, pricing is a story. You know, it's a story that people tell themselves. Why would someone pay $1,000 for a hoodie? And other people won't even pay $20 for it. It's the same same thing.
Yeah, it's like wine.
Exactly. Yeah. Why would you pay $100 for that bottle and just $4 for the other one? If you don't appreciate it, it's just the story. It's the experience. It's what we believe it's worth to us. And that's a good thing. Yeah. I mean, and I've heard that before. You're too cheap. It can't be quality. It can't be good. It can't be anything for us. Yeah. Interesting. Let me see. Looking also at the time, I wrote my book, The Remarkable Effect, and we founded, I think, 3 companies right now, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. The whole reason why I wrote the book was to figure out what are those traits that these companies have, the companies that we start talking about and keep talking about, what do they do different from the ones we don't talk about or stop talking about? Is there anything you do in the way you run the business whereby you optimize for remarkability?
I want to say, I love that word remarkability or just remarkable.
Yeah.
Because we have a culture of excellence. right? What does that mean to us, right? When you're small and you can't compete on resources and money and talent and brand, what you have is your integrity. That's what you can compete on. And what does integrity mean? It's not just like the attitude that I treat you, my customer, my partner, my team. It's also the love and the discipline that we put into every single aspect of our business. Every feature, every pixel, every design, every communication must be remarkable because that is the brand that we're going to compete with, yeah. Right? Like if somebody has never heard of us, I want them to want to partner with us because they feel like we are reliable. And we are reliable because we have integrity. And yep. That has always been the way I've led every single business. And even back then when we were selling to the enterprise, like right now it's much easier because, hey, it's $100. I can risk $100.
Yeah.
But when you're selling a $10,000 to $100,000 contract to the top three companies, like brokerages in New York, and you have no customers, why would they sign up for you? Exactly. The question that they're going to ask is, if you disappear next year, what am I going to do?
Yeah.
That's what you're competing against. Yeah, well, they exactly. have to know that if they invest in you, that you will never let them down, that you will treat their customers like they treat their customers or even better. If you say yeah. something is going to be delivered, it will be delivered early or latest on time.
Yeah.
And that's how I've always thought about integrity is, even with eWebinar, that we don't now that we don't talk to our customers really face to face or through voice, if they ask for something, if we have a feature that we want to be delivered, it will be done and spec'd holistically. We're not just going to do this thing and say, hey, we have it. A lot of software companies do that because it's cheap and it's easy and fast.
Exactly.
If we do something, we're going to imagine how you're going to use it, what questions you're going to ask, how else you're going to want to use it, and then we spec it holistically and then we deliver it. Because we also can't afford to have more support tickets. Everything we do is perfect because we want to lower our own support and we don't want to go back to doing it again. If a ticket comes in and it's urgent, it's not like, hey, how do I, you know, change the text on this button? Like if it's urgent, if we feel your urgency, it will be responded to immediately as long as we're awake. And, you know, we cover European hours, but also North American hours, but we have to. And then people are like, oh, you guys are always there. You're reliable. And then they go to another company and they come back because yeah. they can't even get a response. So they're willing now to pay the premium that yeah. we are. So I think when you say remarkable and what we do that's remarkable, like that's what comes to mind is we do everything with integrity.
Really good. I mean, I love your answer there. And that's what it's really all about. And the good thing is also, and you talked, I got a question around bootstrapping, but everyone can do this. You don't have to be a company of the size of Google or Amazon and so on to do something remarkable. You can do it in any process, in any phase, in anything you do, in anything you ship, as long as you got a brain.
So yeah.
It's a customer-focused mindset. Like, how is the other side going to respond to this? Is this something they're going to say, okay, yeah, it's good enough? Or it's something that they're going to talk about to their friends because you surprised them. It was exceeding their expectations, how small it is. And sometimes it's just a little note that you write in. But anyone can do that. I like that. But integrity is super important. Small business, large business, people bet their career sometimes on you, even with an expense of $100 a month.
Yeah. Yeah, we're powering their business, right? For a lot of companies, we're powering their demos, their sales pitches, their first orientation, their first activation webinar. So we want to make sure that people feel safe with us. Yeah. And a lot of times, if I'm also very honest, and that's part of integrity too. When people say, I want this, I don't try to make them happy. I just say, hey, we're not going to do that because that's very specific for you. And here's why.
Yeah.
And then now it's a conversation. Now I'm not trying to please them.
No.
Or if there's something that I can't fix right now, I just tell them, like, I got your message. I'm on it, but it's 12 o'clock at night and I can't get somebody on it. So you're going to have to give me some time. But then they feel safe. Right? Yeah. They feel like I'm not someone that they have to go and try to knock on my door, find my phone number so they can text me. So that's the environment that we want to create, you know, for our customers. And this is easier as a small company than as a big company. Because as a big company, people are more forgiving. If you're Google, they'll be like, yeah, they're Google, you know, they're going to take some time to get back to me. Or You can't even get through to them unless you're paying them some ad dollars, right? But the bigger the company, the more forgiving people are. But
yeah, I get your point.
Yeah.
Still, I think it's a mindset and it's something that even large companies can keep if they want to. Talking about bootstrap mindset, do you ever think there will be a moment whereby you'll say, okay, we've bootstrapped enough, now we're going to find external funding?
No. I say external funding, like not institutional funding, like no VCs, you know, we've got a credit line with Capchase that we can pull. Of course, it's not in the millions, right? It's like hundreds of thousands, but we will never take institutional funding.
Any specific reason for that?
I love being free. Exactly. And it goes back to that, right? Like there's no free money. And if somebody comes to me and says, I will give you $5 million for 5% and no board seat and you can do whatever you want, I'm going to take it, right? But that person doesn't exist because it's all business.
Exactly.
And I love calling my own shots and not having an office and having a fully remote team that's contracted, right? I like being off grid for 2 weeks a year, you know, and like, I don't want to lose that. I don't want to invite a boss. I can change everything in my business tomorrow and no one's going to challenge me on that.
Exactly. Yes.
I don't have to get approval. Right. I can spend it on anything I want, right? Related to the business. And I think losing that for me would be really, really painful.
Yeah.
And I just don't have, I think some people have ambition to be like, I want a $100 million company. I'm going to sell it for $1 billion, or I really want an IPO because that's my life's goal. I don't have those goals.
No.
I just want to have fun, you know, travel, hang out with friends, see more places. Yeah. And I don't want to be miserable. I think those are my goals. And
yeah, exactly.
If I continue on doing what I do right now, I think we're on a good track to get there. But as soon as you invite an investor, I think things will change.
Exactly. Okay. Last question that I have for you. From all the lessons that you've learned so far, tidbits of wisdom that you've gained, what would be a do and what would be a don't that you would like to share with peer tech entrepreneurs on the mission?
What would be a do? Well, I think do is definitely, before you do anything, define your own definition of success. I think we're taught that like success is raising money, right? Getting into TechCrunch or $100 million, whatever that is for you. Mm-hmm. But if you really look inward and ask yourself, what is enough, right? That becomes your idea of success. Because I think it's really important, especially when you're starting a business and it's so hard already, to have some end goal, right? You don't want to be perpetually trying to get to this place just for the heck of growing.
Yeah.
And Silicon Valley is very good at that, right? You have to grow, you have to grow, you have to keep growing. But for what? If you know what your personal like definition of success is, then you know what you're doing this for. And it becomes, I think, more fun and less exhausting. So great definitely point. Do that. A big don't do that I have is don't build a career or start a business because you think you have to, due to your experience or your education. So an example of that is I started two real estate companies because I was always in real estate. I had jobs in real estate. I knew everybody in real estate and it was what I knew. And I started two companies in it, but I always kind of hated it. Like I hated it to the point where even when we had success, I couldn't celebrate it because I just didn't like being in that industry. I didn't like selling software to agents and supporting them. And what I didn't do was ask myself, what are the things that make me happy? And then find something that fits that definition and then learn the skills, right? We always start a career based on skills, forgetting that that's the easiest part. To learn how to do something should come last. Happiness is the hardest part.
Yeah.
So don't start something because you think you have to because of where you come from. You can always learn what you need to make it successful. Start from a place of love and happiness. Find something that feeds that and then figure out how you can make it successful.
Great points to end the show with. I mean, this is really why I'm doing this, you know, having guests on my podcast like yourself. Thank you very much for sharing the knowledge, for sharing the story, the lessons learned. Good luck on the next step of the journey.
Thanks so much for having me.
It was a pleasure. And this ends my conversation with Melissa, and I hope you enjoyed it. And if so, please leave a review on iTunes. And if it inspired you, please share it with other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that you have in your network. Other than that, thank you for tuning into this podcast. I had the honor to speak to Melissa Kwan, co-founder and CEO of eWebinar. As said, the goal that I have in this podcast is twofold. Firstly, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. And secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what is required to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. Before I close, I have two more comments to make. If you know other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that have a story worth sharing, please send me an email at tom.dobby@valueinspiration.com. Building the momentum all starts with revealing the ideas, and that starts with you. And if you want to know more about my book, or you're interested in joining the Remarkable Effect Tribe, please visit my website at www.valueinspiration.com. Thanks for tuning in. And you could do me a big favor by rating the podcast on iTunes or provide me with your feedback directly. I'll see you shortly on a new episode.